Okay, so next we have David Lemieux, who's going to, his topic's preserving the Grateful Dead's audio collection and making it accessible. Since graduating with an MA in film archiving from the University of East Anglia in 1999, David has been the Grateful Dead's audiovisual archivist, where his primary duties include producing CDs and DVDs drawn from the band's vast audiovisual archives. He also hosts a daily show on Sirius XM satellite radio, selecting music from the Grateful Dead's archives and discussing its historical significance and context. I'd like to invite David, you're going to speak here.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to keep it somewhat brief today so that I can keep some time at the end for questions. And what I'm going to do is give a background to this collection that we've always referred to it in-house at Grateful Dead Productions, which is the company that's been producing these CDs and taking care of this collection since 1966. We've referred to it as a bit of an inadvertent audio archive and film archive, in that it was never built in order to amass a collection of 16 or 17,000 audio tapes, not to mention 3,000 videotapes and probably about 14 or 1,500 reels of 16-millimeter film and then a lot of Super 8 and 35-millimeter. We have the same formats that we've been hearing about at Indiana, but really only since about 1965 when the Grateful Dead started playing and when they started recording everything. And the initial recordings were never looked at as a future thing. It was always living in the moment. And to give a little bit of background to how it started, I'll talk a little bit about the Grateful Dead's first sound engineer and really their first archivist and their benefactor, a guy named Owsley Stanley. If you refer, I'll refer to a guy named Bear occasionally, and Bear is Owsley Stanley. And a little bit of background to him, because it's important how he became the Grateful Dead's benefactor and sound engineer. He had made, I won't say a fortune, but he'd made a comfortable living in 1965, 66, manufacturing and distributing LSD. And this is when it was still legal. It was still a legal drug, and he thought he was doing the world a favor, which I guess in 66 he might have been. I believe it was outlawed around October of 1966, which is when those activities ended, but he had a lot of money, and he really liked the Grateful Dead. He saw in the Grateful Dead a musical kindred spirit to what LSD was allowing people to do, to venture outside of who they were. He thought the Grateful Dead was the perfect house music for an acid trip. So he took a lot of his money, if not all of it, and became the Grateful Dead sound engineer and moved the Grateful Dead from San Francisco to Los Angeles, thinking that this is the best way for the Grateful Dead to make it. So they lived in Watts, and all they did all day was record, rehearse, and play gigs. And Bear had the wherewithal to record all of this stuff. And the only reason he did it, he never saw it as anything important happening for the future. He saw it as a way for the band to listen back and critique what they were doing on any given day. Maybe they were coming up with a new melody that might become the big hit, which it never did. But he kept recording. So Bear Owsley recorded 66, early 67, and he was recording to 10-inch tape. He was recording quarter-inch tape running at 15 IPS. He knew enough to make a good stereo recording, do it at 15 IPS to make it sound as good as he could on the equipment he had. 1967, Bear left. And throughout the Grateful Dead's recording career from really 65 to 95, there are gaps in the collection, and they're all for a very specific reason. And we can pinpoint that there might be 6 months of missing recordings, and it's because an engineer left. Or in Bear's case, he went to work with another band from 67 to 69. He worked with Quicksilver Messenger Service. So in that time, there are virtually no recordings from 1967, 1968, except the Grateful Dead were smart enough when they were working with a record company. In the early days, it was Warner Brothers. They would self-produce everything, and they would spend their own money on producing these things, which meant that they got to keep their tapes. I was talking with Toby earlier about David Bowie and keeping his master recordings, and the Grateful Dead knew that if they took no money from the record companies, they could do whatever they wanted. And then ultimately, at the end of the process, deliver a finished album, keeping all of these tapes. So from 67 and 68, early 69, the Grateful Dead were working on a few live albums, and they kept all these recordings. So we now have these recordings in the Grateful Dead's archive. Again, inadvertently, they just happened to record. And now, 2010, we're able to use these recordings for commercial reasons. and really make them sound as good as possible, preserve them. We'll get into preservation in a minute. If anyone has any questions about how we're preserving the collection, please do ask at the end of this. So the Grateful Dead in 68 had no two-track recordings. They only had a few multi-tracks for these projects. 1969, Bear came back. He was done with this other band, Quicksilver, figured that the Grateful Dead was where he wanted to be. So from 69 to the first half of 1970, it's virtually a complete collection of 200 straight Grateful Dead concerts recorded to two-track. And Bear knew enough that if the Grateful Dead were playing a small hall, which was pretty common in 69, early 70, that, for instance, a lot of the guitar would be coming directly off the stage through the band's own equipment, not through the PA system. So Bear knew that to make that tape sound good, he'd have to add some of the guitar into the recording. So Bear would be doing his job as the front-of-house mixer. He'd also be recording knowing that the tape he was making was for listening purposes. It wasn't just a document of what they played and how they played. It was so that it would be a pleasurable experience for these guys afterwards. 1970, July 16th, actually, which was kind of an important night for the Dead because Janis Joplin sat in with them. So there's a very famous tape of the Dead playing with Janis Joplin. And after the show, Owsley, the law finally caught up with him. And they got him after the show, and he went away for a couple of years. So for about 9 months or 10 months before the recording crew, the stage crew started recording again, we have another nine-month gap where there are absolutely no Grateful Dead recordings. And that really goes from July 16th, the night Bear was arrested, of 1970, through the spring of 1972, when somebody on the crew said, hey, you know, we liked what Bear was doing, which is to say the band enjoyed critiquing their own performances. They enjoyed going back to a hotel room after the show, listening back and saying, gee, we could maybe make that a little better, and this melody that we discovered live on stage could become a song. So they had one of the crew members start recording again. And because the Grateful Dead, their crew was a little different. You didn't just have a drum tech. You had a drum tech who might also know quite a bit about audio engineering because he'd sit in the studio and hang out during the recording sessions. So now you've got a drum tech who's also making recordings and doing a pretty good job. And in fact, he would often neglect his stage duties to make these excellent sounding tapes. So from 71, 72, we have another big collection. Bear got out of prison in 72, started recording again. His front of house position was gone, so all he did was record. So then from 72 to 74, once again, we have a collection that's virtually the entire two-year chunk until the Grateful Dead went on hiatus. So then this collection keeps being built with really nowhere for it to go. The Grateful Dead had no headquarters. They didn't have a vault. They didn't have anywhere to put this stuff. So it ended up at the record at Bear's house or at maybe the drum tech's house. Finally in 1975, which is really the beginning of the Grateful Dead's archive or the vault as it got to be known, the Grateful Dead rented a huge facility in San Rafael, California that became the band's studio equipment warehouse when they weren't on the road. And finally, they built a tape archive, realizing that there was no commercial value in this stuff, but there was historic value. A few of the crew members said, you know, this stuff is pretty big. We've been doing this for 10 years, and if we go for another 10, we're going to have a huge collection. They ended up going 20 more years. And that's when the band, around 77, 78, started actually putting some resources into building a proper room and proper climate control. And it stayed in this place until 1994. The Grateful Dead bought a massive Coca-Cola bottling warehouse in Novato, California. They turned it into their office and their merchandise distribution center and the tape archive and the recording studio. And this is when they finally put some serious money into climate control and fire suppression and built a 2,400-foot vault. That's where I ended up working. And in fact, they started building this facility in 94, and in 95, in August of 95, Jerry Garcia, he was the Grateful Dead's lead guitar player, he came into the facility, and for the first time and only time, he checked it out, popped his head in the vault, made a few suggestions, actually, that we ended up sticking with, and he died the next day. So it was, Jerry got to see the vault once. So it's unfortunate that vault's not there anymore, because in 2003, the Grateful Dead sold that building to a Marin mountain bike company and then leased back a portion of the building, but not the portion with the vault. So we actually had to move the vault about 100 feet. And it was a scene. And then from 2006, the Grateful Dead shut that entire facility down, and we moved the tapes down to North Hollywood, to the Warner Brothers facility, which, in fact, is probably the best facility it's ever been in. The Grateful Dead have signed into a long-term licensing agreement with Rhino Records, a division of Warner, and they get to take care of have to or get to take care of these tapes. And I've been there every couple of months. I go down to the facility, and it's a huge place, and they've got about 600,000 or 700,000 tapes in this facility, of which the Dead is about 20,000 pieces, and they've caged it off. They've got a team of about 6 or 8 archivists at Warner Brothers. They don't want just anybody going in there. So we have specific rules on who can access it, and there's one guy in particular who takes care of it. But it's probably in its best hands, and really since 95, the preservation of this collection has become the most important aspect, because this is how the band has started making their living in the last 15 years since they stopped touring in 1995. A little bit of discussion about the archival CD releases. In 1991, Grateful Dead were probably one of the top 2 or 3 grossing bands in America. They were constantly doing about $35 to $40 million in touring money. So the idea of putting out an archival CD release really didn't interest them. They just saw it as something that would just kind of get in the way of things, that even if it grossed $2 or $3 million, it didn't really mean that much to them. Finally, in 1991, they were convinced to do it, and it did incredibly well. And more importantly, the fans loved it. The feedback the band got was that we want more of these things. And that was from a multi-track recording. So the band thought, if we're going to do these, we're only going to do the best stuff. We're going to take 16 and 24 track recordings only, and we're going to produce proper live albums. Now, to get back to something I said earlier, the Grateful Dead maintaining control of their recordings. When the Grateful Dead would do a live album from 1969 or 71 or 72, they would record an entire tour, and they would do it either 16 or 24 track. By 1978, they were exclusively 24 track. They would keep these tapes. And so now we have this incredibly huge archive, probably 300 or 400 concerts on 16 and 24 track tape to draw from to make proper live albums. So the first one came out from a 16-track source, and everyone loved it, and the band said, okay, you can do another one. So then they got a little, recording crew got a little bolder and went with a 1-inch 8-track tape that, again, was received incredibly well, 1968 recording. And then in 1993, I guess, the Dead's archivist prior to me, Dick Latvala, he pitched the idea of using the 2-track source tapes, which the band said, absolutely not. You know, these were specifically for us to listen back and critique our performance. These are certainly not commercial documents. So nonetheless, Dick put together a few ideas and gave them to the band, and the band was pleasantly surprised by how good these things sounded. Again, most of the 2-track material was not simply a PA feed, which I think anybody who's heard a PA board tape of any live recording can sound pretty terrible, because it reflects how it sounded in the hall. Again, if there's a lot of guitar coming off the stage, usually you won't hear it in the PA mix. A lot of problems, but with the Grateful Dead, they were mixing, really all of their engineers from the 70s, the 80s, were mixing specifically to tape. So they were making these 2-track recordings specifically to listen back to. So they presented 3 ideas to the band, and the bass player in particular was absolutely astounded by how good it sounded. He said, you know what, go for it. He put one of these out with virtually no cost of production, only a mastering job. We didn't have to mix. We do have on engineers who work for the band, but with a 2-track source, you're talking 3 or 4 weeks of mastering instead of 3 or 4 months to mix a multi-track show. It did incredibly well, and the band said, okay, you can do another one. They kept doing it, and finally, by the 5th or 6th one, the band said, you know what, we don't want to know anything about these. We don't want to approve them. We don't want to listen to our own music. We trust what you do. Yeah, just do it. And this, we know you know what you're doing. And then in 1995, everything changed, and Jerry Garcia died, and the Grateful Dead shut down as a touring band, and then this income by then of about $40 million a year was gone, and they realized now we are a merchandise company, and we have 35, 37 people working for us, and we don't want to lay any of them off. So turn the archival release program into our main source of income. And then it became 4 of these 2-track sources a year and 1 of the big multi-track. The multi-track releases that we do would go into stores and become the big release and sell very well. We do DVDs. That became the Grateful Dead's main source of income. And I don't even know if the band made all that much money off them, but it did keep 37, 38 people at its peak in 2001 employed. And it was very important to the Grateful Dead. We had a meeting when they decided, they were getting up in age a little bit and didn't want to manage a company with 30 people anymore. And that's when they decided to shut down. In 2003, a massive round of layoffs, and then they outsourced all the merchandise. We still did all of the audio in-house. And it was 2006 when they finally shut down Grateful Dead Productions, and Warner Brothers and Rhino took over. And I'll tell you, when the band had to shut this down, it was really sad for them. These were people, a lot of them had worked with the band since the late 60s, and then people like me, I came in 1999. They did not enjoy the process, and they really made sure Rhino kept a small team together of engineers and archivists and package designers and people like that to make sure that the quality was going to be exactly the same as it had always been for Grateful Dead Productions. Really important for the band. They even kept the Grateful Dead's longtime non-tape archivist, the photos and the contextual stuff. They kept her on staff for quite a while. Now, you might have heard in 2008, UC Santa Cruz took over the Grateful Dead's non-music archives, and that's when really the end of the Grateful Dead's archives, non-music archives, really began, because UC Santa Cruz is now going to be taking care of this. And the nice thing is with the university is they're going to fund it, amazingly. They're going to fund getting everything in this collection digitized. And from what I understand, it was four semis of material. Is every contract the band ever signed, every letter a fan ever wrote to the band. So it's sad to see it go. It's sad to see the collection broken up, but it couldn't go to a better place than a university like Santa Cruz, where the Grateful Dead had very early roots in Santa Cruz in the South Bay, and it almost went to Stanford, which would have been nice also because the Grateful Dead really began in Palo Alto. But nonetheless, that's where the non-music archives are. So, you know, it's doing well, how the collection is now fragmented, but we continue doing what we do. So when we need photos for a CD release, we go to Santa Cruz, and they, instead of Eileen, the Dead's longtime archivist, they now dig through the archives and find contextual photos. So I'm going to wrap it up and leave this for questions now. If anyone has any questions.
Yeah, you mentioned the film material. Is any of that, have you worked with it at all? I guess my question is, does any of it overlap with the Mary Prankster archives? Are you aware of that material? Have you worked with it at all?
It doesn't. We have 1-inch, which we've since converted to DigiBeta, of a lot of the acid test. Keezy's son, Zane, he now runs all that. So they have that. I'm not sure how they're taking care of it. I talked to Zane quite a bit about other things, so I should ask him that. But we do have copies of everything, and if we ever wanted to use it, we would license it through Keezy and the Pranksters. And they're still, I think the company's called Keezy Productions. So they're still incredibly active, and they do occasional releases. They just don't market the material that well, so you don't really hear about it as much. And nor do they have the resources, whereas with Grateful Dead Productions, when we do a film project, we have the resources to go and find the best transfer facilities in San Francisco and transfer to HD, and really we can spend some money. If we need $40,000 for a transfer, we can make it work because we know it'll make its money back, whereas the Pranksters don't quite have the money to do the transfer the way it should be done. So point being that I think they've released it several times in several configurations, and none of it is that good, unfortunately. So it's the kind of thing that a lot of it is Super 8, a lot of 16. Ideally, somebody would get their hands on it and just really do a proper transfer once and for all. So no, we don't have the masters.
First, thank you for the Winterland recordings. Very much thank you.
Good. Very welcome.
Now, second, I know that a lot of the JDB stuff and the Legion of Mary stuff has been tied up in the Garcia Foundation. Are we going to start seeing more of that coming in through Grateful Dead Productions?
No, you won't see it through Grateful Dead. They're really, more than ever, I think, two separate worlds now.
Okay.
But and I only really know what was public about the split between the Grateful Dead, or between the Jerry Garcia recordings and when they split from Grateful Dead Productions. But they are right now on a massive archival backup of that material, which means, yeah, I think so. I think that they're spending considerable resources on getting this done right, the Garcia collection, much more than Grateful Dead has done on archiving our own collection. I think it's almost comprehensive what they're doing, at which point I think you'll see they do a series called Pure Jerry, the Garcia estate, where they take Jerry. Jerry had a huge career outside of the Grateful Dead, where he played with bluegrass bands and blues bands, all sorts of things, and the question is really about where is that material, and it was stored with the Grateful Dead material until 2004, I think, and then it went down to Los Angeles to Hollywood Vaults, which is the best facility around, and it's a small collection. It's a very manageable collection where, if anybody's seen Hollywood Vaults, the bays where they keep the tapes are quite small, and it fits in one bay, but it's the kind of thing that virtually all of it is good. And there's a lot of the 1975 through 78 material, which is really some of the best. Unfortunately, a lot of the sidemen Jerry played with you have to obtain all those rights. So there's certain versions of Jerry's bands that I don't know if we'll see releases because of rights, but hopefully so. The main job is, yeah, that is the main. I work up, I live on an island up in Canada, and it's a good life because I do exactly the same job I did with Grateful Dead Productions. I oversee all of the music releases, but I do it from up there. So I'll listen to reference material up there, either on CD or DAT or email files. We do a lot of sending things up and down through email. And then when we go to production, I work with the archivist at Warner Brothers. He'll pull the tapes, and then the Grateful Dead have insisted that all of the material still be mastered by Jeffrey Norman, who's been the Dead's mastering engineer and mixing engineer for the last 20 years. So that material then gets shipped up to Petaluma, California, and it gets mastered there. And then Jeffrey and I, during production, are on the phone 4 or 5 times a day going over things, and he'll ask, you know, he's an engineer, I'm more of a content guy, I'm certainly not an engineer, and he'll ask, where do you want the fade in, fade out here, and we'll play it over the phone, or he'll send me a little snippet, and then we go through it that way, and then I do all the proofing of both package materials and the CDs themselves up there. So exact same job without walking into a tape archive every day.
The Dead are famous for their bootleg recordings. Are there any bootlegs that fill in the gaps of those holes? The second question is, your Sirius show with the Dead Channel, how much access do you have to these archives to play on the air?
I have full access. Yeah, I have full access. Most of it is in reference copies that we've made over the years, whether that's on hard drives or CDs, directly out of the vaults. Rarely do I call up something that's in the archives that I don't have access to in some other high-quality format. And everything I have is pretty much on WAV files, so it's good enough for airing. So the Sirius show is it's pretty comprehensive in terms of what I have access to. And the other question was...
Bootlegs,
yeah. Well, we do, because I'll give you one example. That there was a tour in May of 1977, probably definitely one of the Dead's best 3 or 4 tours they ever played. And the engineer took a lot of those tapes home with her. And nothing malicious, but she knew that these were the best 4 shows on a great tour and wanted to listen to them. So she listened, and this happened on several tours in 76, 77, 78, to the point that maybe 100 of the best shows of those 3 years did not end up in the Dead's collection. And then, yeah, and then she had a bit of a falling out with the band and put the tapes into a storage facility. As it was common, didn't pay her bill, and these went up for auction. And some Deadheads bought the tapes, and they've never given them back, but that's okay because we have got pretty good copies of all of them directly off the masters. And the last copy we got was a flat pass with nobody EQ'd anything. They're not HD CD encoded, transferred, but they're pretty good. And we've used a few of them for archival CD releases. It's rare that we use them. We prefer to come right off analog tape or digital tape in that regard. And we do. We've been offered a lot of things where people say, hey, I hear that you don't have this tape. We'll take it. You know, if it's decent enough quality, and even if it isn't and it's the best quality out there, we'll take it to fill in the gap. Because the Grateful Dead's collection, it's important for a couple of reasons, mainly the historical significance of it, but also it's a commercial archive. So I think they like to have access to everything should they ever need it. One last question?
What is your preservation? And also internet archive, I was wondering about
your relationship. No relationship, really. I use it all the time. I use it for reference purposes all the time. And preservation plan, really none in place, except to, I should say that when we do a commercial release from a show from 1977, we'll have all the tapes from that tour sent up to us, sent to Petaluma, and we'll do a backup of every one of those. And we go to DVD-R at high resolution, 2 copies, and we send 1 east and keep 1 in California. So that's what we're doing. We just don't have the resources or either the money or the bodies to do it. So we are doing it somewhat methodically, and we have backed up most of the beta PCMs from the mid-80s, which were having a lot of problems, and a lot of the DATs from the late 80s through about 92, the DATs were having a lot of dropouts. So we're doing the best we can.
very much, David. Thank you very much, David.